show heard Fridays now at 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
We won't stop the killing. Every week of this trial, like every week of the past 7 years, will be measured by new Hiroshimas and by new lies, by the deaths and imprisonment of Americans, and by tens of thousands of new Indochinese killed, wounded, or made homeless. We won't stop that. But this trial will inform the American public in ways that it's never heard before of how we've been governed in the past quarter century and what censorship and deception do to a democracy.
Daniel Ellsberg, way back at a press conference in 1971 as he was awaiting his trial. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here in New York City, WBAI 99.5 FM, stream at WBAI.org, support at give2WBAI.org. I told you last week that Daniel Ellsberg was going to do the show today. Now, as you know, he made it public that he has inoperable pancreatic cancer. So that was the news that shook the world a couple of weeks ago. But he did want to continue speaking out against the war and speaking out in particular in support of Julian Assange and Daniel Hale and others. So I spoke to him last night. He was going to do the show today, but he has some kind of procedure in Northern California there in the Bay Area. But he is listening because I told him who was going to be pinch hitting for him. And so he was very excited. And I'm going to get right into it. I'm not going to play any segue music because I got too much to go over. We're going to talk about Daniel Ellsberg and the work that he has done with two heroic individuals. And that is my dear friend Ray McGovern, who's been on the show many times, and Scott Ritter, who has in the last 4 or 5 months been on this show many times. You know who they are. And later on, John Kiriakou. So when I told Ray, when I told Daniel about this, Reggie, that he was very excited that I have these three individuals on, and two of them are waiting right now.
Yeah.
So as you know, I said it last week, and I'm not really reneging on my promise. If I don't go on my trip next Wednesday and postpone it a few days to Russia, I will have Daniel Ellsberg. I'll tape him sometime over the next 4 or 5 days and put it on next Friday. But let me get to – I want to thank Kelly Lane, who put that opening together. She has put together other files for me today of past interviews over the last year and a half that I've done with Mr. Ellsberg. And most recently – with Scott Ritter. Now, Scott, it was just a few weeks ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, it was Matthew Ho, you, and Daniel Ellsberg and me, and I, of course, was a fly on the wall, which I planned to be today. When you got the news of his illness, how did you take it?
No, I mean, it was a crushing blow. I mean, here's Daniel Ellsberg. He hasn't been well for some time now. And I think anybody who knows Daniel knows that. He cut back his social engagements. And because of COVID, he's limited his person-to-person contact with people. But his brain is as active and vibrant and you know, sharp as it has ever been. And we saw that when we were on when we were talking with him. You know, like me, the older he gets, the more difficult we have with hearing things. But you know, once you recognize what's being said, his brain is right on, sharp, and it was totally unexpected to find out this horrible news. And it was also very sad to hear not only that it's terminal, but that it's going to happen so quick. But he's at peace with it. That's the thing that struck me, is that I'm not allowed to mourn, because he doesn't want that. What he wants, I think, is for us to celebrate life, not just his life, but all life. But, you know, we're here to celebrate. So that's where I'm at on that.
You know, it, not only does he not want you to mourn, he wants to continue the fight, because he is going to be doing, he told me he plans to do a lot of interviews if he can, whatever he can do going forward. I feel a little ghoulish and uncomfortable even asking him, you know. So the fact that he's not doing this today, I'm okay with that. And because it's a weird position to be in, talking to an individual that is in the situation that he's in. Ray McGovern, I guess you heard the news, you got the email, and how did it strike you?
Well, it struck me in many ways. It was a very poignant notice. I was one of a very few. I think his first email list was down to about 500.
Yeah.
500. Very close friends, with whom he always signed off as Love, Dan. I thought that odd in the beginning. I got used to it, and I get to realize that this was authentic. That's what the man is all about. I mean, when he said back in 71, somebody asked him on his way at the court, "So you're going to go to jail for revealing secrets?" And Dan, without a thought, said, "Wouldn't you go to jail for the rest of your life to stop a war?" So there you go. You know, greater love no man hath than he act and sacrifice for his friends. And his friends were Vietnamese as well as Americans. So, you know, my hat's off to Dan, and I like both your thoughts, Scott's, and yours, Randy. We're not supposed to mourn, you know. We're supposed to spend that mourning time doing stuff.
Right, right.
Doing the kinds of things that Dan would do if he was fully up to it. Let me add just one little vignette. Dan, in the Bronx, we call people like Dan a real mensch, okay? A guy who is not only bright as hell, but cares deeply about other people. Many people don't know that Dan was an amateur magician. He could pull a rabbit out of a hat if he had the hat with him, okay? Well, he usually had the hat with him. By that, I mean the handkerchiefs and all that kind of stuff, that in case he needed them, and he needed them. And this on this one occasion, I remember distinctly, Frank Graviel, he's a major in the Danish intelligence service, which is the military service. He told the truth about Iraq. He was sentenced to prison. He was a single parent with one daughter. Her name was Marie, still is, and she was about 8 years old. And so here's Frank preparing to get somebody to take care of Marie. He's going off for almost a year. And what does Dan do? He pulls a rabbit out of a hat. He goes into his briefcase, pulls out those long handkerchiefs of various colors, and he entertains Marie for about an hour or so. Craig told me later he couldn't have wished for a greater blessing to divert her attention and to get her a little happy and a little surprised, and a little magic always does the trick. So there's the mention
right,
in Dan.
Right.
Who knew?
Yes, yes.
How many knew that he was a magician as well as all these other incredibly integrity type qualities.
You know, Orson Welles did that too. You know, Orson Welles was a magician and would do that with children a lot. But that's for another day. I'm going to go to you, Scott. You know, on the last show that we did with Dan and Matthew Ho, you talked about the inspiration. Because I mean, you've been out there. You've been demonized. I mean, you've gone against the grain. You haven't backed down. But you said a lot of it had to do with the inspiration that Dan Ellsberg gave to you way back in the 70s or the 80s.
Well, no, I mean, he set the he's the trailblazer. I mean, when we speak of, you know, whistleblowers, he's the. You know, he's the GOAT, the greatest of all time, the man who did it when nobody else was doing it. And he did it in a big way, a huge way, a dramatic way with, you know, horrific consequences for him. But, wonderful outcomes for America. I mean, we had, freedom of speech was tested. It went to the Supreme Court. We had. You know, the constitutional interpretation regarding free speech was, you know, was clarified because of this. And we got to see him as Ray alluded to, is a man of the utmost integrity, willing to accept imprisonment if it meant stopping a war, you know, putting himself above all others. So, you know, when it came time to, you know, do the right thing, so to speak. In my case, I'm one of these people that I will lock myself into a room, put on some music, and close my eyes and think really, really hard about what it is I'm getting ready to do or contemplate. And before I resigned and stepped off into the brave new world of speaking out against bad policy in a public way, I did just that. And Dan Ellsberg was, because this was before Julian Assange. This was before Edward Snowden. This was before, the modern whistleblower. When you spoke of somebody stepping out, it was Ellsberg. That was it. That was the case study. And, and his courage in doing this was motivational and helped, I knew what I was going to do, but this helped me solidify what I was going to do.
Right. I want to play because, you both know that he's 91 years old and he's been out there and he has not been in great health, but he never spares himself. He's been fighting for other whistleblowers. Here's a clip on the, I think it's the Espionage Act, or is it the Dan? Yeah, let's play the Espionage Act here, talking about Julian Assange. This is from a few months back. Daniel Ellsberg talking about the Espionage Act here as it relates to Assange.
In Britain, Judge Barrett, sir, who, as Angela pointed out, dismissed all the legal arguments and the constitutional arguments for dismissing this trial in favor of the real physical aspect of it, mental health. I wouldn't have expected her to be as understanding as I would have liked an American judge to be of the constitutional aspects over here. Britain has an Official Secrets Act, which they don't have a First Amendment protecting freedom of the press and of speech. That was a product of the American Revolution that Nathan Hale was fighting for. So we had the revolution, we got a First Amendment, they didn't, and they have an Official Secrets Act. So Julian would almost clearly, or I, have been guilty of violating that Official Secrets Act. We don't because we have First Amendment, and as a result, we don't have an Official Secrets Act which criminalizes any and all release of classified information without authorization. But they're using the Espionage Act as if it were an Official Secrets Act. That's clearly, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a defendant. But the lawyers I've read on this were good, say, clearly unconstitutional, especially against Julian, not a former official, never signed a secrecy agreement, clearly a member of the press, blatantly unconstitutional, and yet that has never been ruled on by the Supreme Court. And of course, in the 50 years since my trial, when I was the first to be prosecuted in this way for violating the Espionage Act by giving information to the American public, the Supreme Court would probably then have ruled that use of the act unconstitutional.
Ray McGovern, your thoughts about Daniel's analysis of the Espionage Act there.
Well, I will say this, that as all of you probably know, James Madison would have been 275 today on his birthday.
Looks good for his age.
Now, Madison, of course, is always considered the author of the Constitution, but he didn't do it alone. He did it with George Mason, who happened to be a neighbor of mine. He died before I got into that part of Virginia. But the point is this, that when they labored on this thing and came up with the best deal that would have been palatable and would have had a good chance to be voted on, finally, George Mason went over to Jim Madison and said, "Jim, I'm sorry about this. I've tortured my conscience on this, but I can't sign this damn thing." Madison said, "Come on, George, you wrote half of it. But what's going on here?" He said, "It doesn't have a First Amendment. It doesn't have freedom of speech in it. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights. I can't, in good conscience, sign." So what happened? Madison said, "Look, George, I understand. Here's a deal. You just keep quiet about this, and I'll send writers up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and we'll get those ten First Amendments signed. I promise you." Now, in those days, promises meant something, okay? That's exactly what Madison did. The Bill of Rights was ratified. You know, this is how deeply George Mason felt about those First Amendments. Now, of course, they're incredibly important. And when you come down to, you know, what Dan did, knowing that he might spend the rest of his life in jail, well, what he did enabled the New York Times, Sheehan, the reporter, to do the stories that really needed to be done to shorten the damn war. It was 71. The war went on for a couple more years with U.S. participation and then died off. Sheehan said to Rick Smith, when this went down, he said, and we have this from Smith. Rick Smith says, you know, Sheehan looked at the documents and he said, "Damn, now we got those bastards in their own language." You know, that's what it was, in their own language. It was documentary. It couldn't be denied. And luckily, the New York Times lawyer, the one who was advising them, still alive now.
James Goodall.
Go ahead and do it, you know, and he did it. So the Bill of Rights, my God, you know, there was something approaching the Bill of Rights in the Magna Carta, but that was 800 years ago, and the British have a very short memory because they've trashed most of it, including habeas corpus and other things like that. So, yeah, so, you know, I just admire Dan for putting it to the test, prevailing, mostly because Nixon overreached. And, you know, it's a function of Dan putting his life on the line, really. And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about what he did with respect to Vietnam.
All right.
3 years, 4 years before he let out the Vietnam the papers. So I'll do that when.
All right, we'll get to that. We'll get that in a minute. I want to get Scott's thoughts on what Ellsberg said about the Espionage Act and how it relates to the Magna Carta. I see my dog is in here. She's behaved because I gave her a very nice bath today at the groomer next door at Chow Bow Wow, and she's resting. I can hear the chihuahua there, but that's good. I think that's why it's live on the fly, Scott. So, Scott, your thoughts. You heard that two-minute clip there. Your response.
Well, see, I take the Espionage Act aspects of this very personally because I was charged with espionage under the Espionage Act after I resigned from the United Nations Special Commission. So I lived this. It's the death penalty, by the way. I just want everybody to understand that. that it's not a joke. The crimes I was charged with under the Espionage Act carry the death penalty. I was accused of spying for the state of Israel. Mary Jo White, that's a name that people who know anything about the Southern
District of New York
and its history of prosecuting terrorists and spies of the high, she never lost a case. David
right.
Kelly, I don't know if that's a name that's familiar with you. He, big FBI guy. He ran the prosecution. So I had the two biggest dogs in the American judicial system sicked on me. And their goal was to silence me. And so Dan Ellsberg is 100% correct. The Espionage Act became basically a tool to prosecute people for the crime of exercising their right to a free speech. And, I mean, it took me, gosh, let's see, 1998, 2000, took me 3 years to get Mary Jo White. And, well, David Kelly died in 9/11. So he that was the end of him. But Mary Jo White and, her FBI team of attack dogs to back down. And they backed down because I confronted them straight up.
Yeah,
I didn't cower. I didn't sit there and say, oh, my God, you put the death penalty. I want a plea deal. They were trying to get the plea deal. I said, plea to what? And I got them in an interrogation room, or actually they got me in an interrogation room, three FBI agents. I'm on a chair that has the old handcuff rings, and they've got the handcuffs on the table. They're playing that game. And when I finished with them an hour and a half later, the female agent was in tears. The other agent had to leave. He was sick to his stomach. And the last agent was apologizing profusely.
Wow.
Because I had done nothing wrong. But for 3 years, they tortured me. They tortured my family because for the crime of speaking truth to power. So I know exactly where Dan Ellsberg is coming from. I lived it. He's 100% correct about his interpretation of the Espionage Act.
Well, yeah, Sky, I have not heard that story from you, at least on my show.
Today.
Yeah, I had no. I think a lot of people don't know about that. That's really.
Brandy?
I got to play another clip here before we. You want to add on to that for a minute before I play this clip? Because I got four clips to play.
I want to say a couple of words, if Scott will allow me. Another news break here. About the fellow, Scott Ritter, who decided to follow Dan Ellsberg's example before the Iraq War. Now, suffice it to say, Scott Ritter, who lives in New York State, that came down to see his senator, Hillary Clinton, the other one, and all his friends, they wouldn't let him in the door. He tried to get in to see Joe Biden, the chief of the Foreign Affairs Committee, couldn't get in the door. Pulling his hair out. Nobody would interview him. So what did he do? Correct me if I'm wrong, Scott. But what Scott did was get an unclassified documentary version of the debriefing report of the Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, who was in charge of weapons of mass destruction and who told the British, the CIA, and UN inspectors they were all destroyed at his order. He told them that in 1995. Now, the interrogation was given to Newsweek. I always really admired the person who did that. I didn't find out until last year. That was Scott Ritter, okay? What did Newsweek do with it? Well, they couldn't ignore it, right? It was documentary. It was a month before the war. And so they put a little squib in what they used to have a little periscope section, but they put it online on the 24th of February, 2003, so a month before the war. It said Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, who was in charge of these programs, said all those weapons were destroyed. So what happened? The press, all the reporters in Washington, decided they'd have to see if this was right. And so who did they go to? The CIA spokesperson. And that spokesperson named Bill Harlow said, no, this is incorrect. It's bogus. It's false. It's untrue. And all those reporters said, whew, well, thanks for telling us, Bill. because we're going to write a story on it. It seemed to be at variance what the government is. Well, you know, that's the guts. I mean, despite Scott's earlier experience at the hands of the deep state, the FBI and everybody else, he still went the last mile, gave him the document, good time before the war to stop it, and that's what the press did with it, namely nothing after that.
It is that all true, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, there's everything Ray said is true. The backstory of that is the thing that kicked it off was Dick Cheney speaking before the VFW and saying that Saddam Hussein's son-in-law defected and told us that there were weapons of mass destruction. And I went, no, he didn't. He told us the exact opposite. And I actually went to CNN and their UN correspondent, whose name I can't remember. I think he's still there. CNN, they did a whole show where I gave them the documents. They ran through them, and then they filmed me. They interviewed me. They had the whole tape up ready to go. And the CIA made a phone call to them and killed the story. So I'm just telling all your listeners out there, CNN works for the CIA. I know this because I've seen it.
We've all seen that. I think it's obvious.
So at the last second, I went to Newsweek, and everything that Ray said afterwards was true.
All right. Well, listen, both of those stories are breaking to me. I want to play another clip here that Kelly Lane, who does the Assange Countdown to Freedom podcast, video podcast. She cut this from an interview, and I don't even know when it's from, but this is about I'm going to play this to underscore Daniel Ellsberg's commitment at age 91 for those who are victims of government repression who speak out. And this is him talking about Chelsea Manning.
Another thing that Chelsea revealed to Assange was a process of torture, by the way. A major thing she revealed was that in hundreds of cases, we were turning over people to the Iraqi Armed Forces prisoners to be tortured when we knew they would be tortured. Now, it so happens that in the laws on this, internationally and domestically, to fail to investigate and, if appropriate, to prosecute, indict and prosecute credible cases, allegations of torture, is itself a crime, like torture. And what Chelsea revealed was this was going under the current president as well, that Obama was in this practice, which was clearly, by the way, what she revealed was that hundreds of, at least more than 100 cases where individuals, Americans in the process, had protested this or questioned it, even as she had to her officer, and had been told, as she was, forget it, don't investigate. Let it go. It's illegal instruction to do that because the law required that be investigated. So she was actually revealing crimes that reached right up to the current president, although it had been started before him. That was Obama. And I think that was not unrelated to the extreme sentences that she got. And the fact, by the way, that she was incommunicado from the time she was arrested to the time she got out of prison. No journalist was ever able to interview her during that whole time. That's why Ed Snowden, in order to explain to reporters what the information he was giving them meant in technical terms, which is not clear from just reading that material, in order to be able to explain that to people, he had to be out of the country.
Scott, you're a former Marine. I mean, Chelsea Manning, did she do the right thing? And is Daniel right in his analysis?
And this is where I get in trouble, because you know you take an oath, and then you're entrusted with classified information, and the system doesn't work if people don't respect that. Now, so I would have to know a lot more about the motivations and what had been done by Chelsea Manning prior to leaking. Now, let me be straight clear. The information that Chelsea Manning leaked was information that the American public needed to know about the wrongdoings and the lies of their government. It was absolutely essential to the proper functioning of a democracy. And so, you know, when you look at the impact of what Chelsea did, there could be no doubt that it was to the betterment of America. But my issue comes to the path chosen. And were all venues possible to redress these issues exhausted before the decision was made to reach out to Julian Assange, or were there, you know, and I, you know, I'm not finding Chelsea guilty. You just asked me a question. I'm being honest that that's one that I have trouble with because I, it, you know, one time in my life, I was entrusted with literally the highest secrets of the land. And, as Ray was. And in order to have a nation that's capable of having those kind of secrets and protecting them, you have to have people who will abide by the commitment they've made not to reveal those secrets. And if you are going to reveal those secrets, then you have to be willing to accept the consequences of your action. And, of course, Chelsea went to jail, et cetera. But it, before I can give anybody a clean bill of health, I would have to know more about the motivation, and I haven't had that the opportunity to have that conversation with Chelsea, and I've read her book, and I've talked to people, and it's a little nebulous. But, you know, we moved past that, and I will say that, you know, the information, you know, and a lot of people point to the videotape of the murder of the journalists as sort of the, you know, the crown jewel of the information released. I don't, because we knew that was happening. All that did is give us a visual image of the murder that we knew was happening every day in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was the diplomatic cables that I think were the most valuable, at least to me, because, and I think to the world, the most damaging to the United States, because they exposed the reality that every single diplomat in the United States diplomatic corps is a liar. They just straight up lie. They lie to the face of people. They lie to the American people. They lie to the countries they're serving in. And then they write these memorandums that go behind the scenes, classified memorandums, where they tell the truth to each other. And by exposing that, they show the duplicity of the United States and how it interacts with the rest of the world. And to me, that was extraordinarily valuable, because now there's no one in the world that can say we didn't know America is a nation of liars. Well, there it is, right there.
Before I go to Ray, to respond to that, I want to play. You alluded to the collateral murder. You can't see it, but just the audio is enough to scare you. This is the audio of a vignette of that collateral murder video.
Bushmaster Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene, looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Hey, we need to stop that. We need to get down there.
Roger. Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage.
I'm picking up the wounded.
I'm trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
Bushmaster Crazy Horse 1-8.
Taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
It's Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV or bongo truck picking up the bodies. Fuck. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on. Oh yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
Those psychotic murderers are still on the loose, and Chelsea Manning did 7 years in prison, in isolation, and Julian Assange has spent 12 years basically in prison. Ray McGovern, you listen to that, and you've seen that video many times. Your response to Scott's analysis?
Well, first, Randy, psychotic murderers, they're not.
They're not?
What's the right word?
Trained murderers.
Yeah, they're brutalized. They're brutalized just as much as any other Army or Navy or Air Force or Marines that doesn't have any respect left for humanity, including two little kids in a van. And, you know, eight people up on top, they're just out to kill. And that's, you know, it's not their fault in some respect. It's our fault for allowing that kind of thing to go forward. Now, with respect to what Scott said, I really, you know, I really admire Scott because he tells you what he thinks and what he feels and the reasoning behind what he feels. He did refer to an oath that we take. And I would just quibble with that because there's only one oath that we take, and that's the Constitution, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, as I reason this, and, you know, everyone's entitled to their own reasoning here, I look at that as what the ethicists call the supervening value, the one that overshadows the value of keeping a promise that you made on a piece of paper. That piece of paper saying you got to keep these things secret because they would endanger national security. Well, that doesn't cover in my, maybe this is jesuitical, that's my training, but that doesn't cover crimes of this nature. So I see a kind of a hierarchy of values here. The oath being supreme, supervening is the word that the ethicists use. And so I admire Chelsea for going out on a limb and revealing that. And of course, it wasn't only Chelsea and it wasn't only Assange. It was Daniel Ellsberg, because he took the same oath and he decided that it really supervened in this case. And yeah, we're really glad that he did.
All right. Well, Ray, all right. So that's cleared up. Scott, I understand what you're saying, but the point, what Daniel was making about Manning is really what I wanted to focus on there. The fact that he continues to speak out. I mean, he's 91 years old. He's 91 years old. He could just go out and have a good time every night until he's gone. But he continues to speak out for you, speak out for John Kiriakou, who may be joining us real soon, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange. And I'm going to play this clip, Scott, and come back to you and ask you what motivates that commitment, that ongoing, unrelenting commitment. I'm going to play this. This is him talking about Julian Assange because he has really focused on this persecution.
In the case of Julian in particular, all the other cases have been, I believe, unconstitutionally, but in any case, have been of officials or former officials who were sources, as I was, to a newspaper or to the media. And in this case now, as the Civil Liberties Union predicted long ago that Trump would do, bring a case against a journalist, a publisher in this case of Assange, like the New York Times or an editor. And they predicted he would do it, and he did do it, which Obama had declined to do, the Obama Justice Department. Biden now is doing as badly as Trump on this. What rides on this is not just the fate of this one man, Julian Assange, who did take on the empire. The Empire Strikes Back, as the movie said. In other words, he really was exposing the criminality and the terrible, dangerous policies as stupid a crime as the invasion of Ukraine. And exposing this to the public. And of course, I don't know whether he did expect, but you might say he shouldn't have expected that they would refrain from using every means unconstitutional to punish him, to make an example. That's already happened. From his years now in confinement. But if he should be extradited and prosecuted, and I think in the current climate, very likely that the unconstitutionality of his prosecution would not protect him. And as I say, it is not his fate that is the main thing there, the continuation of his current confinement, but it is the very possibility of a free press.
All right. Well, there you go. Daniel's been on the show many times, and we have various shades of gray on the situation in Ukraine. He takes a different point of view than I do. But notwithstanding that, Scott, the question is how he has, come to bat enthusiastically and unrelentingly in support of those who are repressed, through the Espionage Act and other nefarious forms of government laws.
No, I mean, you've obviously spoken about the examples for Chelsea, the examples for Julian Assange and Ed Snowden. I can just vouch for what he did for me. When I was speaking out, I would be attacked vociferously, called a traitor, called everything in the world. And to have Daniel Ellsberg, who didn't know me from boo, I was just this dude out there doing my thing on Iraq. But he listened. He decided that he was going to take his considerable reputation and put it out there and say, you got to listen to this guy. You got to listen to Scott Ritter. And it wasn't just that he did that. He actively cooperated. We flew, we'd fly to Oakland and meet with Dan. We'd do public calls with Dan. Dan would, support me in that way to get attention to what I was saying. He was so, selfless in terms of his willingness to put it all on the line and in support of a good cause. And I'm very proud that Dan Ellsberg seemed to me to be a good cause.
Ray, your thoughts?
Well, I've got two things. They're sort of related. Let me start with how Dan was treated by the New York Times. They never told him they were going to publish his story. They never congratulated him or ordered or invited him back to the New York Times for 40 years. Finally, they decided, 40 years, we'll brag about being so brave, and we'll invite Ellsberg and some of his friends to come, and we'll have this new auditorium. It'll be great. And Jill Abramson, the new executive editor, will talk. And, well, I happened to be in town in New York at the time. So Dan said, come along, Ray. And we sat there. And they didn't say much about what Dan had done. It was all about what the New York Times did, how they faced up to this. One of their former executive directors said, let's be honest here. We knew there was competition. We know the other papers had it too. So it wasn't complete bravery. It was competition also. But what I remember most is that Jill Abramson thought it a good idea to brave about how brave the New York Times was in publishing James Risen's revelations that Bush and Cheney were spying up the gazoo on all of us, right? Now, I rushed to the microphone that was in the balcony where I was, but before I could say anything, Dan Ellsberg said, now, Jill, I have real problems with that. You waited a whole year. You waited till Bush won his second term. Risen had that stuff in July of 2004, you waited till December 2005. That's you don't brag about that, Jill. So I didn't have to say anything. The other thing I want to mention has to do with Dan as a mensch, okay? He was never out for himself. He is never out for himself. That shows through in the letter he sent, okay? Now, what am I saying? He was the hero in an Academy Award winner, or a follow-up, actually, called The Most Dangerous Man in America, which is what Henry Kissinger famously called him. Now, he didn't seek the documentary. It was done by a little group in Berkeley who thought it would be a good idea. Well, it's a finalist in the competition. Well, why do I mention this? Well, I was out there. I was visiting the Ellsbergs, and when the door opened, Patricia appears in this incredible, incredible evening dress. And they say, Patricia, that's so nice of you to welcome me to this. And she smiled and said, Ray, I'm trying on dresses for the Academy Awards. So I said, okay, fine. And then Jan told me later, with respect to dresses, that the producer had a dress that was really expensive things, except in the taxi going there, it fell apart. And so Dan, Patricia, and the producer all said a big prayer, please don't let us win. Please don't let us win, because this dress is going to fall apart on the way up to the to the stage. Did he want to win? Well, he says, I didn't care if I won. I didn't want her to be embarrassed. So there's Dan, the mensch, okay? It didn't matter if he won. It mattered that she would be embarrassed because her dress fell off. And those are the stories about the two dresses that I left pass along that are really poignant when you think about Dan's attitude in both cases.
All right. That's a wonderful story. I'm glad I never got an Academy Award, but we're going to play something. You have something to say, Scott, before I play just one more clip that I think is significant? Go ahead.
No, please.
All right. Now, this is another case. Kiriakou is flying into Ronald Reagan Airport in D.C., but he's not there yet, so he's not going to be on the show. But I was going to play this while he was here because I was at the sentencing of Daniel Hale, and Daniel Ellsberg talking about another whistleblower who has been persecuted. We'll be right back.
They said, we won't put Julian in a highest security prison. Well, I just talked on the phone to Daniel Hale, who is in prison right now for revealing murder, an assassination program by the drone program. In other words, instead of a helicopter shooting down those citizens, you have a Hellfire missile from a drone directed thousands of miles away by somebody in Texas. So Hale reveals that for every targeted person, which is already an assassination, no due process, 17 others untargeted are also killed. So you have a serial murder. For that, he's in prison right now. And where is he? In Marion, Illinois. Well, I said, Marion? You're in prison in Marion? That started the Supermax prison. It was the model for the Supermax prisons. He said, well, now they have three other ones, and they've reduced things in Marion. It isn't as bad as it used to be. So if they promised they wouldn't put Julian in, let's say, the AMX somewhere, or one of the two or three Supermax, he could still have the worst conditions possible.
Yeah, well, there you go. And I bring that up because there was a drone shot down. I want you to, Scott, talk about what he was saying about Daniel Hale and revealing the drone program and this recent incident involving the shoot down of this surveillance drone that could have been a drone with a weapon on it, I think.
Well, I mean, the MQ-9 Reaper drone is fully capable of carrying weapons. Put an armed drone like that up against Russia near the Crimea is a suicide act. The MQ-9 is not a combat aircraft. It can take out terrorists. It can take out villagers. It can take out wedding parties. It can assassinate American citizens, but it can't take on the Russian Federation. But what it was doing was carrying out an espionage act in support of a nation that was at war with Russia, and that made it a party to the conflict. That's not my interpretation. One only has to go to international humanitarian law and how they define parties to the conflict. We're engaged in a war, but no American's been told about this war. We've been told we're not engaged with war. No boots on the ground. We're not at war with Russia, but we are at war with Russia right now. Very much so. And we use, ironically, the drone program, the one that was exposed by Daniel Hale. Many Americans didn't understand that every day the Nobel Prize winning president of the United States of America was slaughtering innocent civilians in the biggest assassination program the United States has been involved in probably ever. Maybe Phoenix in Vietnam surpassed it. I don't know. Either way, it's a competition. And we wouldn't have known about this if it weren't for Mr. Hale. And again, as I'll say, if the took an oath. This is where it gets really murky with me, man. It's tough because, you know, you can't violate the oath. You can't violate the non-disclosure agreement. But we needed to know this. America needed to know this. This is one of the problems with our government. Secrets aren't designed to deceive the American people. Secrets are designed to protect the national security. And if the national security is contingent upon the deceit of the American people, then this nation shouldn't be secure. Straight up. And so, you know, Mr. Hale, you know, exposing the lies of the drone program by telling us that we are mass murderers. Our president is a mass murderer. All presidents who operate the drones are mass murderers. We've seen that with Joe Biden, the unapologetic approach they took to the slaughter of a family in Afghanistan that we knew wasn't criminal, but we did it anyways because we can, because we have these drones, we have these weapons, we have a system, we have a military that is immune, apparently, to the notion of being a murderer, that they somehow legitimize their actions because they buy into the fiction of what they're doing. And we can thank Mr. Hale for shining a light on that. And we can thank Daniel Ellsberg for giving Mr. Hale additional credibility by putting his own, you know, unmatched reputation out there to back him up.
Well, wow. Ray, I mean, what choice did Daniel Hale, of a person of conscience, who did sign this oath, and he sees that the Constitution is being violated by committing these crimes, did he have any other choice? I mean, there are others that know about it, and they kept quiet. Maybe they were afraid that they would be persecuted. Someone of conscience, does he have any other choice than to go public and expose violations of the Constitution? Well, we didn't give them the right to kill 17 out of 18 people or even the individual that's targeted.
Well, that's right, Randy. And just going back to the collateral murder video, which you played a little audio from, Chelsea Manning didn't have a choice. David Finkel of the Washington Post was embedded in that very unit, and we know he saw the collateral murder video. Did he report it? No, he wrote a book applauding this unit, and he won some sort of award for it and got promoted in the Washington Post. So, you know, it comes down to a person who has a conscience. And let me ask you just one other thing. Scott talked earlier, and he's exactly right, as usual. He said, Dan Ellsberg did the right thing, okay? Now, when we were giving Ed Snowden the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence in Moscow in the fall of 2013, I visited Fordham University, where Dan Berrigan was in the infirmary, okay? And I said, Dan, I've been talking to Dan Ellsberg, and also I'm going to see Ed Snowden. What would you say to Ed Snowden? Now, he was very frail, and he looked at me in his raspy voice, and he said, Ray, tell him he did the right thing. I said, okay, well, I will. Now, I told that Dan Ellsberg that I might be seeing you this week. What would you say to him? He looked at me. Tell him he does the right thing, too. So, simple as it is, it's the supreme theological principle, if you will. Do the right thing. That's what Dan Ellsberg did. And thankfully, he's been a model to people like Scott Ritter and so many other people, Chelsea Manning, who have done the right thing, and he has supported them up to the hilt, right to his 91st and 92nd, hopefully, year.
All right. Well, Ray, that's the I was going to ask both of you, but you pretty much summed up your feelings about Daniel Ellsberg. I'm going to give Scott, because we only have a minute and a half left, Scott, some closing remarks about the person that we are celebrating today, and that is Daniel Ellsberg.
Well, I mean, Ray, you know, hit it on the head. Do the right thing. Do the right thing. I mean, again, it's funny. What, you know, because I was put in this very nebulous situation with the CIA when I was a U.N. weapons inspector, because I wasn't a U.S. government employee. I was an international civil servant, but I was a loyal American, and I'd always confront this CIA operations officer who was assigned to the unit that was supporting us, and I'd say, what do you want me to do? You know, I'm in this quandary that, you know, if I do this for the United Nations, the CIA is going to be mad at me. But if I do this for the CIA, I'm violating my oath to the United Nations, but I'm an American, then my loyalties are, what do you want me to do? And he would always look at me and say, Scott, do the right thing. And I said, what does that mean? And he would say, Scott, do the right thing. So I'd always go with the United Nations because that's where my integrity was. That's where I gave my promise, my oath. And when I resigned and they started coming after me, I had a conversation with them. And I said, you know, you kept telling me to do the right thing, and yet you guys are charging me with espionage, and you're trying to kill me, and you're doing this and that. And he said, God, sometimes doing the right thing comes with a price. And he was right. And that's, you know, and you think about Daniel Ellsberg. This is a man who did the right thing. But he also knew that, unlike me, who found out afterwards, after I did the right thing, what the price was going to be, he knew going up front what the price was going to be. Can you imagine the courage it takes? Because I have to be honest with you. If I had known going up front what the price my family and I would have paid for doing the right thing, it's a coin toss, baby. I'm just being honest with you. It's a coin toss. Because we paid one hell of a price. And so I can't tell you right now in good faith that I would have done the right thing. I may have been that coward that said, it ain't worth the price. I'm taking the easy way out. Dan Ellsberg didn't. He knew right up front what the cost was going to be, and he did the right thing. This is why when they put in the pantheon of the greatest Americans that have ever lived, Dan Ellsberg's got to be right up there at the top, because he is one of the greatest Americans that ever lived. And he's alive today, and we should celebrate his life, and we should celebrate forever, because, my God, what a great American. I salute the man. I love the man. I appreciate the man. And it just, I'm going to celebrate him for as long as I have a breath in my body.
Well, I got to tell you something. You got me choked up here, and before I start crying, I'm going to let both of you guys go. That was beautiful. I want to thank Ray McGovern and Scott Ritter. You guys are profiles in courage. I will be talking to you soon. You'll be back as often. When I get back from Russia, I'm going to go to Russia next week, and when I get back, you guys are going to be the two people I brief on this show. Scott Ritter and Ray McGovern, thank you very much. We're going to let you guys go and do a couple of minutes of business here before we go out. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Most welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Scott. All right, so there you go. Reggie, we just had another show with two individuals that you don't see on MSNBC or CNN. We only have a few minutes left. This is another reason that people should support this program or this station.
Absolutely. I think that the closing moments of Scott Ritter pretty much said it all. It's like about the consequences of doing the right thing and what side are you on? Are you on the side of right or you're on the side of the United States? And sometimes, more often than not, they are not non-compatible at times. And here at WBAI, we at least make efforts of giving you that perspective. And if
we have a few minutes, Reggie, yeah. What do people got to do?
And, well, if they and if you, the listening audience out there, respect that, well, please show your support to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go online to give to WBAI.org.
There's no premium involved today. We're just asking for direct donations or to become a buddy. Quickly, can you do it in 20 seconds? How to become a buddy in 20 seconds?
All they got to do is just call the number or they go online and you just ask to become a sustaining member, which is also known as a WBAI buddy. And tell them what to do, how you want to do it. You could do it with your credit card, your debit card, and and it's pretty easy. It's just, you know, set it and forget it. $10 a month, at least. You could do that and do that.
Yeah. But I'd like to see them do is just make a flat out donation right now. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. If you like the kind of program, if you don't, then I understand. If you'd prefer to spend your money on Ari Melber. Eric, yeah, play that. Ari Melber and Wolf Blitzer and all these other cable shows. Go ahead. If that's your priority, yeah. Do that.